This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Every year, tens of thousands of baseball fans come to downtown Durham to watch the Durham Bulls. The team is one of the most well-known minor league baseball teams in the country, partly due to the 1988 hit film Bull Durham. But the team was a success even before the movie. In his new book, Ron Morris looks at the origins of the Bulls and how the team revitalized baseball for Durham in the 1980s. The book is called No Bull, the real story of the rebirth of a team and a city. And Ron Morris joins me in the studio now. Welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Oh, thank you for having me here.
You took the 1980 season. Of course, that's when the Bulls came back after a hiatus. Well, tell us about that 1980 season for the Durham Bulls.
The 1980 season was, there's only one word that can possibly describe it. And it's an overused word. Sometimes it's cliche, but it was truly magic. Just everything that happened that season, off the field, on the field. A lot of times when you're part of watching something happen, you don't realize the historical significance of it because it's happening in real time. But in reflection, it was truly a historic year.
Well, and maybe people in Durham and the area could be forgiven for not being particularly excited about it because the Bulls were a team. Durham had a team until 1971, and it mostly faded for lack of interest. And so when they come back in 1980, people could be forgiven for not paying much attention.
Sure. And the fact of the matter was minor league baseball was dying. Yep. It was dead. There were only 2 years earlier, there were only four teams in the Carolina League. North Carolina as a state at one point had 23 minor league baseball teams, and by 1979 they had three. Yeah. So baseball was dead, pro baseball was dead, and the sentiment among the community when they had this grand idea to bring baseball back was, here we go again. This will never work.
It'll never work. One of many times they've said that in Durham and been proved wrong. But now, important to the success of this team in 1980 and the reason that it was magic was a manager affectionately known as Dirty Al.
Alan Mitchell George Patrick Henry Gallagher was his full name. Okay. And as Furman Bisher of the Atlanta Constitution wrote at the time, as if he didn't have enough names, they called him Dirty Al.
And why did he get that nickname?
Well, he got it because he was a filthy, dirty person. Plain and simple.
Tell us more.
He had tobacco juice that would, you know, come off on his chin and drip down onto his clothing. He also was involved. He actually picked up the nickname when he was in college. He went out of the stands the night that he was going to attend the prom after the football game and went out of the stands and entered himself in a greased pig contest, chased down the pig, went back into the stands, and went to the prom with the pig droppings on his suit. So he earned the nickname, but mostly beyond his nickname, he was just a colorful character. And a character, I mean a character, to the nth degree. He believed, and this was really unusual at the time, most baseball managers at the time were there to develop baseball players solely. He believed that part of managing a team was also entertaining the crowd and keeping them on their toes and making sure that they got their money's worth for their $5 admission.
So tell us how he would do this.
Well, if there was an umpire to be argued with, Dirty Al was going to do it. And he would charge out onto the field, much in the manner of Earl Weaver. And more times than not, most of his tobacco would end up on the clothing, if not the face of the umpire. And he would do things like little routine foul balls hit to the third baseline foul.
Yeah.
He managed third also, and he would pick up the ball. And most managers would either throw the ball out of play or toss it back to the pitcher. He would wind up and throw a knuckleball back to the pitcher.
He also did some imitating when an ump might make in fact, I think he wasn't it a day later when the ump should have called a home run as far as Dirty Al was concerned, and it called it foul. He replayed the whole thing.
Yeah, well, actually, that was another manager in the league, in the Carolina League, Buddy Hunter from Winston-Salem, who one night early in the season not only pantomimed what had happened the night before, but then took his act to first base and pulled off his shoes and pantomimed throwing hand grenades at the umpire, picked up the base, carried it off the field, got a standing ovation from the Durham crowd, was fined by the league for that, and the Durham fans took up a collection to pay his fine. And that was just more of the magic of the season, where these side acts that went on all year.
Okay, so showmanship, a big part of what's going on. Beer, also.
Beer was key. In 1979, the state of North Carolina, for the first time, allowed the public sale of beer, which played perfectly into the Durham Bulls coming back in 1980. On top of that, the drinking age was 18. So Miles Wolf, the owner of the team, recognized this nice little convergence of rules and laws.
In a college town
such as Durham. In a college town where he could attract college kids from Raleigh and NC mm-hmm. State, from NC Central, from Duke, from North Carolina. And so he began, right off the bat, they charged $1 for beers, $1 for a 12-ounce beer. And before long, not only did he have the Duke community coming into the ballpark, they had the entire Triangle community yeah. of young adults attending games there. It became, quite frankly, the best bar in town.
And you claim in your book that this played a no small part in improving relationships, some of the town-gown relationships between Durham and Duke.
I don't think there's any question that before 1980, there were Duke students who, for the most part, came from the Northeast, who would come to Durham, attend Duke for 4 years, leave Durham, and never see downtown Durham, and because there was nothing down there. And the Duke community essentially operated on an island from the city of Durham. And that season, there was a mesh of Duke students, Duke alums, Duke professors, and the working majority of Durham, from doctors to lawyers to sanitation workers. It was just this incredible melting pot of a community behind this one cause of yeah. a minor league baseball team. It was beautiful.
$5 ticket, $1 beer, that's everybody's invitation, right?
It was the first time since the 50s with the advent of TV that there was really affordable entertainment offered yeah. to a community.
So you've got that going on. Now, you mentioned the characterization in the Atlanta Constitution of Dirty Al. Why would the Atlanta Constitution be writing about him? Well, because the Durham Bulls at the time were the farm team of the Atlanta Braves, owned by Captain Outrageous, Ted Turner. Remember him?
Who could forget Ted Turner? He, of course, founded CNN. Mm-hmm. He also founded the first national cable network other than the three major networks.
Yes, I remember that. It's still going.
And he purchased the Atlanta Braves. Yeah. Well, the Atlanta Braves were just another TV show for him. It was TV programming.
Yeah.
And he didn't really much care whether they won, lost, drew, did not matter. And he was in the business of providing entertainment, an entertainment show on his network. Well, during the one season, he decided, this was around 1976, he decided he wanted to manage the Atlanta Braves. So he put on a uniform and went into the dugout and managed one game for the Braves, and they lost. It continued a 13-game losing streak.
It wasn't his fault.
Yeah, it wasn't his fault. And the commissioner of baseball stepped in and said, no, there's a little-known rule that you can't both own the team and manage the team. So Ted Turner took off his uniform for the one and only time, returned to the front office, and was greeted the next week by many people on the front office staff on the baseball side of it who had decided they were going to quit. They'd had enough of Ted Turner and the way he was running this baseball franchise. Mm-hmm. And so he sat down with Bill Lucas, who was the general manager at the time, the first black general manager in baseball history. And he had a great deal of respect for Bill Lucas and how he felt about things. And Bill Lucas told him, this is no way to run a baseball franchise. What you need to do is stop signing free agents, stop treating it as a TV show, and pump all of your money, which he had plenty of, into the minor leagues and developing players, and we will build a consistent championship team. Part of that need for developing players was more minor league teams, and one of the teams they added was a high Class A team in Durham.
Very interesting. And, of course, you point out that this was at a time when basically minor league baseball was in decline. So had it not been that Ted Turner, loaded with cash, gets the good advice that you've got to build your team from the ground up, that may not have happened.
It may not have happened. There were so many things like that. It would just seem like happenstance. Yeah. That just played into this magical year.
A magical year. The Bulls are starting. I mean, talk about attendance there, because they're playing in this old stadium. The DAP is the old stadium, which is not far from the new stadium. But tell us about playing in that stadium.
Well, it was a rundown stadium that most minor league parks at the time had already been destroyed. Thankfully for the city of Durham, the John Sprunt Hill family, when they purchased the land back after a fire in the 1930s, wrote into the gift of the land to the city that land could never be used for anything but a ballpark. So when baseball left Durham, they just had this vacated ballpark down there.
They couldn't redevelop the park.
They couldn't redevelop it, but they also couldn't. They could not tear it down.
Couldn't tear it down.
And so the structure remained, but it was in complete disarray. Yeah. One franchise owner came in to look at it as a possibility of putting a team in here, and he said the best thing they could do with that place is throw a couple sticks of dynamite to it, blow it up. Miles Wolf had great foresight. He looked at it and said, "This is beautiful. This is exactly what we need to get people to come back to watch baseball." And I'll tell you one quick story about one of the problems with the park is in the right field line was about 285 feet from home plate to the right field fence. Well, that's extremely short by major league standards and even by minor league standards. And when the Braves came in to look at it, one of their concerns was, "Well, this is too short a fence. You can hit too many home runs from right-handed or left-handed hitters, and the pitching statistics will be skewed because of this porch in right field." And so Paul Snyder, who was the director of scouting for the Braves, looked at the fence and he said, "Well, we can solve that problem." And I said to him, "Well, how are you going to do that?" And he said, "Oh, we'll just paint 305 feet on the sign." Problem solved.
Is that what they did?
That's what they did.
They did. So that's 1980, and things are moving along, and the attendance is building. And along comes the film, 1988, Bull Durham. What role did that play? Wait a minute, excuse me. Did I say Bull Durham? This is our excuse to gratuitously play the clip that we play every year, usually on opening day. Today, because the news was so bad, we couldn't do it. Here is that clip now from Bull Durham.
Excuse me, what the hell's going on out here?
Well, Nuke's scared because his eyelids are jammed and his old man's here. We need a live rooster. Was it a live rooster? We need a live rooster to take the curse off Jose's glove, and nobody seems to know what to get Millie or Jimmy for their wedding present. Is that about right?
That's right.
We're dealing with a lot of
Okay, well, candlesticks always make a nice gift, and maybe you can find out where she's registered, maybe a place setting or maybe a silverware pattern. Okay, let's get to it. Here we go.
Yeah, there we go. The clip from the 1988 movie Bull Durham, which we find a way to get in every year. We're late this year, but we did it. And I'm talking to Ron Morris, the author of No Bull. So what role did that film play?
Well, we got to back off a little bit.
Yeah.
Because my contention from the outset in writing this book was the Durham Bulls were highly successful before the movie. The movie just extended that success into the stratosphere. Because in 1980... The general manager of the team at the time, Pete Bock, had a sign, one of those old like United Way bar graph signs, in which they wanted their goal for the season was 80,000 in attendance. And by the halfway through the season, they had 80,000. They'd surpassed 80,000. They finished the 1980 season having drawn 175,963 fans. Phenomenal.
Yeah.
Beyond everyone's expectations. And by 1990, they were drawing 300,000 fans a season. So they averaged 175 to 200,000 up until the movie, and then it moved from 200,000 to 300,000 after the movie because people wanted to go see where the movie was filmed.
And there's actually a story about how it came to be filmed here, isn't there?
Yeah, that's an important chapter in the book, is how the movie came about. And Tom Mount, who was director of Universal Studios at the time, the Durham native. And Ron Shelton was the director of the movie, and he wrote the script. And Tom Mount wanted the movie to be filmed in Durham, but he didn't tell Ron Shelton that. He sent him out on a two-week mission around North and South Carolina. He drove around to all the standing old ballparks to pick out which one he thought would fit best for the film. And he came back after the trip, and he told Tom Mount, there's no question, it's Durham, which is was music to Tom Mount's ears.
Validated. So what's the effect right now of the Durham Bulls in this city? They keep breaking attendance records. What impact has it had?
It's been anyone who drove through the city of Durham in 1980, and particularly downtown, and now as we did today to drive through downtown, you wouldn't recognize it as the same city. In 1980, when I worked in downtown at the Durham Morning Herald, we did not dare walk alone to our cars at night. There were very few people downtown, and most of them were panhandlers or thieves or whatever else. Now you walk in downtown Durham and there are five-star restaurants. There's a five-star hotel. There's a Titanic condo complex going up. That's been the transformation in the city of Durham. My contention is that were the Durham Bulls the sole reason for that, the success of the franchise, the sole reason? No, of course not. But they certainly sparked this revolution of Durham. Durham in 1980 was clearly the armpit of the Research Triangle. Chapel Hill had so much going for it. Raleigh had everything going for it. Durham had nothing. And now, Durham, believe it or not, I think people who know now, Durham is the cool place to visit. It's the cool place to live. There's so much going on here. It's for me to see that, it's just mind-blowing.
Ron Morris, the new book is called No Bull, The Real Story of the Rebirth of a Team in a City. It's going to read June 24th at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Lots more information at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.